At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games presented to you by two walking husks of human beings. I am your dental pain addled co-host, Mark Bigney, and with me is my respiratory challenged co-host, Michael Walker. How you doing, Walker?
It's good.
It's the best he sounded all week.
Hey-ho.
So we are not at our full capacity, but nonetheless, we would never dream of leaving you in the lurch. There are all these people, Walker.
That's right.
All these people who need to know how wrong we are games.
They want to know the cutting cusp of the gaming world.
The cutting cusp of the gaming world? Yes. I suppose
that's the new lingo.
That's what we do? We cut the cusp?
We cut the cusp, baby.
Okay. Fair enough. So with that in mind, we're going to talk about board games this week. We're going to talk about the games we played last week. We're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. And then we're going to talk about our feature game. Our feature game is Kutna Ora, The City of Silver, published by CGE Games. Because since Vladikvadl doesn't publish anything anymore, they got to turn to somebody.
They got to put something out.
So, Walker, what did you play last week?
Mark, I got to show you a game called Raising Robots. This is designed by Brett Sobel, Seth Van Orden, and put out by Nauvoo Games. This was a Kickstarter, and it's very much sort of playing on the Wingspan sort of vibe. You are collecting these robots. You are trying to generate energy. And then you get to choose what actions you're going to funnel this energy into. And maybe the rest of the groups has put some outside energy onto some of these actions as well. Sort of like Roll for the Galaxy, just Galaxy style. Like they've all done it different ways, but everyone picks the two actions they want to do. And they might put some energy on the board. And then everyone, even if you didn't pick that action, if that external energy is there, then you get to use that and do that action.
There's roughly an inverse correlation between the potency of the action you're going to do and the amount of assistance you give to everybody else in doing that action. So everybody has this deck of 8 energy action cards, and very unsatisfyingly, it keeps the gameplay down, but it really narrows the horizon of decisions. You get to choose 2 actions every round, and you're going to get 2 random cards off your energy deck with which to do them. So I might pull my 2 and my 5. My 2 doesn't let me get to do much, but it doesn't assist anybody else in doing the thing. So in point of fact, it may be the case the action I picked and that I assigned to the 2 won't get done by anybody else if nobody else picked it. The 5, on the other hand, drops an energy on the space, which means 2 things. Not only is it the case that everyone else gets to do the action whether they picked the action card or not, but everybody who does the action will do so in a boosted way. And so that is, in theory, driving the, what's that thing we call player interaction?
Yes.
But in practice, this is starting some of my criticisms here already. In practice, given that you have such a limited range of options with respect to your energy cards, and given the fact that usually your own priorities in terms of what actions you need to get done are so much more salient in front of mind and transparent to you than what anyone else is doing, I find that element to be, in experience, effectively random.
100% agree. It is definitely a heads-down game all the way through. You might say that, you know, this is the little bit of interaction that there might be, but it was really not there. It's just accidental and inconsequential.
You want to hear my really bad crack?
Sure.
Hey, Raising Robots, 2020 called. It wants its generic tableau builder back. That's a little unfair. It's not quite... It doesn't feel as generic as a lot of other tableau builders, especially, as I say, of 3 years ago. The fact that you have to be careful about how powerful the actions you're executing are. Again, there are these energy thresholds. And the higher the threshold, some things might not trigger at all, or they might trigger more cheaply, or what have you. That, I think, was the really differentiating aspect from the hordes of also-rans of the so many tableau builders we've already played. And it was vaguely novel, at least in that sense. I kind of appreciated that it was doing something a little more interesting with the resource scarcity. Resources are very scarce, and I kind of appreciate that from a lot of other alternatives where there's too many resources flying around. So it didn't feel entirely generic. Did it, however, stand out in a very, very, very crowded field? In my estimation, no, not at all.
Well, I think the art does that. I think the upgrading abilities that you can sort of pick your upgrades in different order and sort of manipulate your tableau different way every game. And the art is just so fantastic in every way that it just makes it a joy to play.
Okay, you are right. The art is relentlessly enjoyable. The fat deck of cards that will go into your somewhat generic feeling tableau building exercise are all these robots with their own name, and they're just these cobbled together monstrosities of different components. Like, there's this weird robot dog called Waffles whose face is a waffle iron. I'm not selling the artwork appropriately. They're all like five or more gadgets that are cobbled together. Some of them are borderline creepy, but that's great. A lot of them are cute. They're all visually interesting. I will give it that. And I did feel that I was doing a little bit of a disservice to the game because I ended up in a position where I had a fair amount of card throughput. At one point, I think I had 8 cards in my hand. And I knew I wouldn't be able to get many of them out. Indeed, getting cards out, as I say, is rather difficult. It's a resource-type game, Raising Robots is. And I did feel a little bit bad that I was just scanning the numbers for some of it. I did actually enjoy far more the portion at the end of the game where everyone was just going through the cards and just highlighting the ones they thought were the most full of personality. The cards had 10 times as much personality as the game did, frankly, in my experience. Agreed.
And I think the flow is very much real. We played with 5. It went very quickly. The only time the game bogs down is when you're just waiting for a couple people to finish up their turn. The first time you're teaching it, you're going to go through each step. But then after that, everyone just does their tableau as quickly as they can. And then you wait for those one or two people to finish up. And then you're on to the next round and you're going again.
I keep getting the sense that what I ought to do is just be the tyrant that everyone jokes that I am and just start bringing Race for the Galaxy everywhere and say, we're just playing this. We're only playing Race, like, for a solid week. All we're playing is Race for the Galaxy. And then you'll all see what the fuss is about.
Yeah, no, I agree. 100% agree.
Anyway.
That is Raising Robots by Nauvoo Games.
And Walker taught me the game, and I thanked him for teaching me the game.
And you did, and I thanked you for thanking me.
No, you don't need gratitude for it. But this, the more I think about it, the more I think it's utterly perverse how little appreciation rules explainers get. I will say, just as some follow-up from last time, a number of people have crawled out of the woodwork, as it were, both on the Discord and in the show's guild on BoardGameGeek, to say that they enjoy teaching games. They enjoy internalizing the rules and then teaching the rules and giving the actual rules explanation. And good for them. Them, I would analogize to the example that is frequently given in the Grounding for the Metaphysics of Morals from Immanuel Kant. They are the friend of man. But as we all know, the friend of man is not motivated by duty. It does not act in accordance with duty, but not from duty. And therefore, it is uncertain, and it is not morally praiseworthy action. Anyway, moving on.
Duty.
Wow. I was expecting a terrible cunt pun. I was not expecting that. I haven't heard that one in a while. Anyway, moving on. We played the second of the 3 new Omen games. Omen is a game that was originally released as Omen Reign of War over 10 years ago by John Cloudis at Small Box Games. After a successful crowdfunding campaign, it's been reimagined as a sort of 3 separate standalone games that can nonetheless be combined. We'd previously played the first version, and this time we played the second set called Banks of the Styx. And I was impressed by how different it felt, for one thing. There was a lot more discarding, there was a lot more triggering abilities, And there was simultaneously also a lot more of what I was missing from the first set, which was putting out forces and forcing the opponent to be on the back foot to deal with them in a slightly more traditional two-player confrontation card game.
Yeah, there's definite setup this time. You know, there's not, right. It wasn't just this one turn big blitz. It was actually setting, okay, I'm going to do this turn, and then I'll be able to set up for my next turn.
Absolutely. And I looking back, I think part of that is just greater familiarity with the system, knowing what setups might be durable and what might be less durable, which is surprising given that in Banks of the Styx, there are tons of ways to murder things. But anyway, also some follow-up from last week, just because there'd been some discussion about it as to the availability of the three games. They were crowdfunded as a group, but now they're available directly through Small Box Games piecemeal. So they're available, the individual sets, and they're going to be available going forward from now until Rapture is the plan anyway. And that's kind of how Small Box Games does things. They've done this a couple times. They crowdfund and then they start selling it on Small Box Games website. Anyhow, I am really enjoying getting more familiarity with the core system, but also watching the different sets iterate and vary on that core idea. And I preferred Banks of the Styx to the first version because in the first set, Songs of Far Shores, in some ways actively disincentivized you to make the first move. You were waiting for your opponent to commit first by virtue of how the keywords worked. Whereas Banks of the Styx, as I said, it felt like there was more buildup. There were the huge combo-tastic turns that completely changed the state of the board, but there was also some laying the groundwork for future action as well. I also just really like the economy of Omen. You need cards, you need money. You never feel like you have enough of both. Sometimes, on some terms, you just accept the fact that all you're doing is getting enough of what you need to set things up for later.
Yeah, and if you get all of one thing, then you get a bonus, right? So there's that urge to always want to get it. It's like, I'm going to get four money. I could get two money in a card,
yeah.
Or I could get four money. Okay, I'm going to take the hit this turn. I'll get four money, and then, yeah.
Right. You get three wealth actions at the top of your turn, but if you commit all of them to the same resource type rather than mixing and matching, you get a bonus fourth. And that, it's surprisingly tense in terms of the trade-offs, that simple rule. Anyway, surprisingly interesting card interactions is very much the hallmark of John Cloudis's designs. And I frankly am very, very eager to see how the new keywords and the new unique units shake out in the third Omen set. This was a review copy sent to us by the publisher.
This week's stream was a game called Set a Watch, designed by Mike Grande and Todd Walsh, put out by Rock Manor Games. Now, I've been talking about Set a Watch for a while now because they've had three separate Kickstarters, and we talk about it on our Pledge of Indifference, one of our bonus shows. And I think I really should have just, you know, bit the bullet and got it right off the beginning because I really do enjoy this game. I loved it. Comes from Xenoshift very much. The enemy deck works very similar to how Xenoshift enemy deck works, except you're all, I know Xenoshift is co-op, but you're sort of have your own line. In this game, everyone works on the same line and you're sort of manipulating your skills and your dice in order to create interesting puzzles in order to destroy like up to, you know, 7 to 9 cards in this line. And you have to go through 9 different locations to get to the end boss. And you're constantly fighting this sort of horde deck that's building through powers of the cards or other things that happen. And you can do special abilities to sort of reduce that. And every time you set to a location, someone has to sort of stay behind and watch the fire or build up the fire. And they have their own sort of dice game that they play. You know, they either look ahead and see where you're going to go next, or they can look ahead and see what enemies are coming up or switch out their ability cards. Because it also comes with a very interesting sort of ability mechanism where you get 3 and they also count as your hit points. So when you use one, you flip it over and you sort of lost a hit point, or you can use one of your 3 dice and just cover it and then not have to flip it over. So it's sort of this trade-off of, you know, well, I could use dice to do damage or use dice so I don't lose hit points. Overall, love Set a Watch. I have a copy coming and expansion, and yes, Set a Watch.
Where are you getting this copy from? I thought you said you hadn't bit the bullet.
From retail.
Oh, great. I remember retail.
Yeah.
Is that how Grandma and Grandpa used to get things?
They did, in the before times.
Oh, wow. I get to play Cryo. Cryo is one of my mainstays ever since I tried it a few years ago, and Cryo was designed by Tom Jolly and Luke Laurie. Luke Laurie is perhaps best known for Dwellings of Eldervale, which is not a game we enjoyed at all. And one of the reasons why I really like Cryo is because it has one of the ideas that showed promise in Dwellings of Eldervale, but dialed up and more prominent. Specifically, the idea that as you bring your workers back, you can activate a sort of customizable economy that you build over the course of the game. In Dwellings of Eldervale, I felt that this was underused, and it was too difficult to get to build an economy in an interesting way, and you might only do it once or twice. Whereas in Cryo, you have all these different action lines, and at various times, you're going to be feeling pressure to activate various elements of this economy as you build it up. And if you haven't built up your economy properly, then you're going to just be running inefficiently, which in lots of Euro games is going to spell your doom, and Cryo is very much the kind of game where tempo matters a lot. And if you can make more use of your actions than anybody else, you're going to be able to drive the pace of things. On top of that, you have an excellent area majority contest because everything ties together thematically. And a point of fact, I was talking about this with Huey after we finished playing, and there are these little subtle elements that really indicate, I think, that Cryo is an underappreciated game. For example, one of the most overt acts of hostility you can engage in Cryo is you can activate a token that will blow up some of your opponent's cryopods. The theme of the game is that you've crash-landed on an inhospitable world, it's too cold, and you have to wake up your cryopods.
They've gotten sick, Mark. They're going to infect the rest of the colonists. You're helping.
Sure. Let's go with that. Let's put that down, cause of death, helping. And you have to wake up these colonists, these would-be colonists and their cryopods, and then send them to the underground caves where they can be warm, and that's how you get the overwhelming bulk of your points. The rest of your points are a rounding error in comparison. And what this does is, what this pressure does is, first of all, it injects a surprising amount of tension for the effect that it has. I think mostly this is because of how it informs the theme. If it's the case that these were just, I don't know, barrels of whiskey, and it just reduced the total supply of barrels of whiskey you could use over the course of the game, I don't think it would have nearly the same sense of tension that it does, knowing that your colonists are dying. And further to which, it encourages you to do the thing that is most advantageous for you, namely, focus on waking up your colonists and sending them to where they need to be. So I think it's one of those things where not only does it lead to a better play experience, it even in the as it punishes other players, as it is a weapon that you can use against them, it encourages everyone to keep their eyes on the prize. And I just want to emphasize that because, again, a very subtle design choice that has very salutary effects on the gameplay experience. It's visually arresting. I think the cover, honestly, is one of the better Euro covers of the past 5 to 10 years. And I think that Cryo is a marvelous worker placement game, very much in the modern style of on your turn, you either put out a worker or you take all your workers back. But it does a better job of making taking your workers back an interesting job because of the way that you customize your economy over the course of the game. And every time I play Cryo, there's at least one other person at the table that says we should be playing this more often. And I could not help but agree. It is not, I think, among the very, very top tier of worker placement games. You know, it's definitely not my top three worker placement games of all time, I'd say. But it is absolutely a Euro game that deserves more attention, and I'm always glad to have played it. That's Cryo by Tom Jolly and Luke Laurie, published by Z-Man Games in 2021.
So I played a couple games on Board Game Arena. One was Form the Day. That's an alpha right now. That's designed by Laurent Lever and Rick Andel, put out by Asmodee, and they did a great job. There was an online implementation previously, which had a great option that after you finished the race, you'd hit a button, and it would sort of real-time you the race
based on
the rules. Yeah,
I love
those. Yeah, and you'd see the cars go around, and it would reenact the race based on your dice roll, but everyone would be moving at the same pace.
Right.
Based on how much you rolled. I thought that was fantastic. This does not have that, of course, but it has the great thing where you like hover over the dice and it'll show you how far they go and what you'll lose and stuff like that. And it made me realize that Form of the Day is actually a splatter game, you see, because you can destroy yourself in the first turn. So finishing the last lap by myself was interesting, but it didn't really lead to that exciting sort of tension I was looking for in my Form of the Day race.
Okay, sure.
And the second one was Rift Force. Rift Force was picked up by a new coder and is now in beta, so it's now available to everyone. It's been changed from how it was before, and it's just that much better. So Rift Force is a great two-player battler, and it has an expansion already, not so much on Board Game Arena yet. And you pick two, it's sort of like Sacre Arms, whereas you're picking two sort of elements or two factions, and you mix the deck together. In Rift Force, you pick four factions.
Yeah, Sacre Arms, you pick two.
Rift Force, you pick four different ones, you mix them together, you play them in lanes, and you either play all the same number or all the same faction, or you're drawing cards, and every time you draw cards, if you own a lane, then you're going to get points. Every time you destroy an opponent's card, you get points. It's this very interesting sort of back and forth and deciding when to draw cards and when to push a lane. And
yeah, the tempo considerations, of all the ways in which I am very bad at Rift Force, I find it so fascinating as a design. I think the tempo considerations are the ones where that constantly stymie them, but they are fascinating. Again, just like I said with Cryo, if you are going to have a sort of a reset turn, there are ways you can make that decision more or less interesting. And I think Cryo and Rift Force are two good examples of games where it doesn't feel like a wasted turn. It feels like you're actively pursuing your interests in doing so, even though in a lot of other games, it would just be a passive reset.
Agreed. I didn't really talk much Formula Day, because Formula Day is one of my favorite games. It is a racing game. It is very much a push your luck. It has these customizable dice that go from, you know, intermittent numbers.
They're not customizable. They're custom dice.
Yes.
They come to you already customized.
That's right. That represent the gears of a car, and they don't all start at one. They have like they come in subsets of numbers.
Yeah, so the D30, which is the biggest die, is I think 20 to 30, and that's the number of spaces you can move in that gear.
Correct. And then the corners, you have to stop a certain number of times, and you have brakes and engine and tires and all these different considerations to make. I love it. I think maybe this online implementation might be great, because it's a good way to get 10 players together.
Sure.
To have 10 cars on the track, and it won't feel so long because...
Yeah.
Because I think it's the kind of game that works okay intermittently playing once in a while. You know, like taking your turn and then waiting for your turn to come up again, because you're not going to lose much. You can see the track and you're ready to go. So I'm looking forward to playing a lot more Formula Day on Board Game Arena.
Just thinking back of our recent experiences with Charioteer... really emphasizes, I think, how Charioteer does corners, I think, a lot better than Formula Day does. Because, as I recall, in Formula Day, there are these zones which are just determined on the map that these are the corners, and you need to stop in them a certain number of spaces. And you end up with these weirdly gamey situations, because you want to stop right at the start of the corner so as to be able to maximize the amount of time you spend in the corner. It always felt like brutally calculational to me and oddly mathy in an unsatisfying way, as opposed to Charioteer, where it's very, very simple. Sometimes there are corner spaces. Are you doing corner movement? Oh, great. You skip those spaces. You're not doing corner movement. You get to go the way Dewey says, the hard way.
Yeah.
And you just don't end up counting as a consequence. You're like, oh, I'm headed into a corner. Can I do corner movement? I don't know.
I also move a lot of spaces instead.
Exactly. I suspect the counter to that would be that there would be some people who would actually count out the number of spaces and strictly determine mathematically which way is better to go, and then it would feel a little bit more like the Formula Day version. But thus far, I have not felt that impulse the same way that I do with Formula Day.
Yeah, Formula Day does a great job because they have the numbers on the side of the track and they have the numbers on the corners, so you can quickly, I'm 10 spaces away from the corner. The corner's 15. I've got 25 spaces that I have to deal with.
That is true.
And so, you know, it makes it nice that way.
I played another game of Piazza Rabazza. This is a dexterity game by Guido Hoffmann and Jens-Peter Schliemann. And it is a marvelous contraption and toy. And when you get to use the word contraption in the context of board games, ever since the grand old days of Mousetrap, you know you're in for something, at least. And Piazza Rabazza is actually not a bad dexterity game. The way that it works is you end up with this magnetic superstructure that vibrates wildly because of a wind-up gizmo in the middle. And you just have to navigate via this kind of plank your pizza delivery dude to deliver magnetic pizzas to the various walls. And actually, I realized that when we played the first time, we were actually playing incorrectly. The risk valuations are actually surprisingly subtle, because when you are making deliveries, you have a specific person that you can deliver to in each quadrant of the city. If you accidentally, and it is so easy to make accidents in Piazza Rabazza, because again, did I mention that the walls are vibrating violently and that they're magnetic? The thematic explanation for this is that people are leaning outside their window, and if the delivery scooter with the pizza comes too close to the window, they'll just lean out and grab it. if you accidentally deliver pizza to some other window, then anybody who has to deliver then to that window at any time, anywhere in their stack, gets to score it.
Oh, anywhere in the stack.
Anywhere in the stack.
We were only doing the top. All right.
I know. All right. And that also makes the game faster, because that was one of my criticisms of the original game. It changes the risk calculus. Of course, if you play too conservatively, then Piazza Robazzo could take too long. But it does make things surprisingly more tense, because you know that there's a hidden risk around every corner. So you have a subset of targets that will matter for you, but during your turn, there are so many more opponent targets that are active. And that really helps drive a lot of the tension, driving, no pun intended.
Yeah, just to make it a little more clear, it is this sort of grid of walls, three-dimensional, and they're raised about, 2 centimeters off the ground, which will allow you to put this, thin piece of plastic with a scooter on the end, so you can drive it around this, three-dimensional town. And then, like we said, you have metal pizzas and then all these magnets in the wall. And suddenly, you can't see on the other side of the wall, and you bring your scooter through and your pizza's gone because someone has stolen it. It is fantastic.
If you're at all curious, I highly recommend checking a video. I think seeing it in action will definitely communicate whether or not this is the sort of play experience you're interested in having. I'm very glad to have played more of Piazza Robazzo. It is a lovely toy, and I think that it is very important, even as super serious adult hobbyist board gamers, that we get to spend a little bit of time with toys whenever possible. That is Piazza Robazzo by Guido Hoffmann and Jens-Peter Schliemann, Zoc Verlag 2022. Those are the games we played last week. Now onto the news and why it doesn't matter.
Today's category. Somebody must have asked for this. Robo Rally Transformers, Mark.
I saw that.
Now, when I think Robo Rally, the last robots that would come to mind would be Transformers.
The last robots?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because it was just zany silliness, right?
Yes.
There's like pusher beams and lunacy going on. And I cannot see, it does not feel like Transformers is the right fit for this game.
Yes. I dare say that absent the Dinobots.
True.
Core Transformers is not heavy in what you would call the hijinks.
Yes.
Generally speaking, when they go somewhere, they do so deliberately. the character who's a Lamborghini, I don't remember him driving around randomly and finding himself turning left when he wanted to turn right. And
you could say it was like a training mission, or
there's any number of thematic explanations you could give. Some sort of something-something virus, something-something energon sickness. I don't know. I was struck, however, that you get to wield substantially more control in Robo Rally Transformers based on the pitch than you do in normal Robo Rally, in that you can decide when you transform, and that it, based on the description, that is not a function of a card you play. That is a decision you make at the top of your turn. So perhaps that actually reduces the... I don't know. It's a strange licensing format. I couldn't help but notice in the same announcements that they're going to have a collector's edition Robo Rally for $120.
Yikes.
That's a lot of Robo Rally.
All right. And secondly, there was a game called Battlestar Galactica. It was sort of like a hidden traitor game. And they sort of reissued it as Unfathomable from the Abyss. And that was several years ago. And now there's going to be an expansion for that said game.
Yeah, people did not seem to react well to the Cthulhu-themed rebranding of Battlestar Galactica. I see more people playing Battlestar Galactica than Unfathomable, which, given how there's a strong recency bias in our hobby, seems to indicate something. But given the Fantasy Flight can only put out Cthulhu-themed things now,
yes,
they don't really do anything else.
That's true.
Yeah. So I'd like to announce with great sadness that Burned failed to reach its funding target. I was very disappointed.
Yeah.
I was very sad. I did all I could. I started the podcast just so I could talk about Burned. I mean, granted, this was what you call a long play, having decided to set up the podcast a solid 8 years before the Kickstarter campaign began. But that was my dedication.
We did a lot of work. Like, this has been a long road.
Yeah.
And I feel bad that it didn't...
All for nothing.
Yeah.
So we might as well pack it in.
Agreed.
Yeah. In other crowdfunding news, this is something actually I'm sufficiently enthusiastic about that I, number one, really should have talked about it on Pledge of Indifference, but I'm sufficiently enthusiastic about that I should talk about on the main show as well, which is Etherstone on Kickstarter. This is by Virginio Gili and Simone Luciani. Now, this is very different from a lot of the design work that Simone Luciani in particular is known for in the past, to a certain extent, Gili as well. And This is because it's a comparatively straightforward-looking card-driven tableau builder thing. And so I'm very curious to see what Luciani brings to this sort of design idiom. And this is by Thundergriff Games. They put out very, very attractive games, as a rule. So our favorite of their recent releases is probably Iwari. That is something we can both get behind. Even though I prefer other versions of it, it is such a solid game engine. Anyway, Aetherstone, up on Kickstarter now.
Lastly for me, we both enjoy the animated series Avatar The Last Airbender. They're coming up with a cooperative deck builder that's going to bring you and your friends through the different seasons of the show. It's called Aang's Destiny. It is rumored that it's just a reskinning of Harry Potter's Hogwarts battle, but we shall see.
That is the news and why it doesn't matter. And now a brief break while we pay some bills.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And we're back. Our feature game this week is Kutna Ora, the City of Silver, designed by, and I'm going to be butchering these names, my sincerest apologies, Andrzej Bursztyn, Peter Czaslava, and Pavel Jarosz, published by Czech Games Edition last year in 2023. Walker, why don't you give us an unhelpful summary about what one does in Kutna Ora, the City of Silver?
Well, Mark, in 1260...
Yeah, okay, 2060 would have been a slightly different game, I think.
In 1260, silver was found in Kutna Ora, and within 20 years, it was producing one-third of Europe's silver. So, needless to say, there was a huge influx of people into this small town. And what you're doing in the game, long story short, is that you spend six turns trying to understand and failing to manipulate the market.
Yeah, that I think in Walker terms is the key hook. It's the market. This is a market-driven board game where there are goods of fluctuating values, and sometimes some of the goods you'll be purchasing, and then some of them you'll just be selling. Like, for example, food is not something that you ever purchase. It is exclusively something to be sold. Timber can be either purchased for building something or can be sold based on income, based on whether or not you built any buildings that give that to you. And it's driven by a series of cardboard sliders and decks of cards.
It's by far my favorite part of this game. There's none of this tons of different resources that you have to keep track of. You simply have money. You want to build something, like Mark said, you need 12 wood. Well, look over at the market. How much is wood? Then you have to buy it. You need to buy this. You need to buy that. You don't store anything except money.
It's true.
Unless you're me playing the game, then you just don't have the money.
Yes, there is a strong burden, I would say, in the early game to build up your income values. Because Kutna Ora, this isn't really a criticism. It's not necessarily to my taste, all told. But it's one of those games where you start off with vastly more money than you're ever going to see again for a bit. right? So there are some board games where you start off with a pittance and you make a lot of money. There are other board games where you start off with a huge amount of money and you're mostly just going to be going further and further down, closer to zero over the course of the game. Your income can't begin to compare. Kutnora is somewhere in the middle of those. You start off with a pretty big whack of change, but if you burn through that and in the process you have not built up a solid income, you can be in serious trouble. So you can kind of build yourself into a corner.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Mentioning no walkers in particular.
This being said, the setup is a beast. There are tons of things to set
up. Really?
There are.
I thought you were being sarcastic.
Yeah, there were three of us setting it up at the same time.
I know. But look. I'm thinking
there are 9 different stacks of buildings that you have to do. Then you have to set up the mines. Then you have to set up. I think it's pretty huge.
Pretty huge is a gross exaggeration. When you consider, I'm surprised I'm defending it because I'm not a huge fan of Kutnora, but when you consider its peers, right? When you're considering medium-heavy Euro games that have been released in the past couple of years, it's not that big of a deal. Because, yes, there are a whole bunch of different stacks of tiles you need to worry about, but they are easy to sort because they have different backs and different fronts. You can just hand them over to somebody, and the descriptor of what to do with, say, for example, all the building and patrician tiles is not difficult. So yeah, there's a fair number of components, but if you compare, this is a bit of an unfair comparison, but if you compare it to Sankore, for example, it ain't nothing.
I suppose.
Or if you compare it to Nucleum, or if you compare it to a number of other Euro games of a comparable weight that we've talked about over the past few years, if you compare it to any of the Great Western Trails,
especially the new ones, yikes.
Yes, absolutely. So yeah, no, I'm not saying that the setup is trivial, but I'm saying that in its sort of design space, it's not that bad. I don't think.
Well, it's not complicated. And like we said, we have the three of us doing it, and we all know what we're doing. It was very short. But I'm thinking the first time playing it, it would be a bit of a stretch.
Oh, sure. I will freely grant you that.
Because on top of that, you have to randomly sort out the mine, and then you have to randomly set up the guilds as well. Then we're going to talk about the guilds. I think that's a very interesting part of the game, too, even though it is a huge front-loaded choice. There are 6 guilds, and you're going to get a subset. You're going to get 3 of those. And you sort of want to get at least one that nobody else has. Because there's a little bit of competition for the buildings for those guilds.
Well, you're going to be guaranteed, actually. The level of interface you have with the other players is very much set at the start of the game. In Kutnora, you cannot buy or build or reserve buildings that are of a type that don't correspond to a guild you have. And so consequently, at the start of a 4-player game, I know that I'll be buying one type of building in common with 2 players, another type of building in common with 1, and one type of building in common with nobody. And consequently, I mean, it's fine. It shakes out to be okay. But there are a couple of occasions where you look overall at the economy and say, ooh, that good's doing really well. I'd like to get on that. Oh, no, I can't. I'm just not allowed. And in point of fact, the economy at various junctures, in some games this won't happen at all, but in other games it might happen several times. The economy is just going to show up and say, why haven't any of you dingbats made any food? What is wrong with you? Okay, we're making food now, dingbats. And the game just kind of zhuzhes the demand by itself. Which leads me to my biggest complaint about Kutnora. I never really felt like I had a solid understanding of the details of what was going to happen. You know how sometimes, and this is when you're playing a digital adaptation of a board game or indeed some other kind of PC game, and you're like, oh, I know that doing this is going to mean that I earn more money. I don't know exactly how much, but whatever. I don't want that in my board games. I really don't. Now, I'm perfectly happy on occasion to make decisions on that basis in a board game, but I don't ever want to be in a position where that's the best kind of decision I'm able to make. And in Kutnora, you might say, okay, well, I want to increase my income. I think I'll do that by building a food building. This is going to increase my food production by 5, but I know that it's going to do 2 things to the overall economy, one of which I know is going to reduce the price of food by how much, I'm not exactly sure. The other thing may slightly increase the price of food either now or contribute to it doing it later. I'm not 100% sure which and when. And the cards could do a much better job telling you about this because, and we know that they can because there's symbology attached to the various prices. One of them is a little asterisk indicating the price has done just changed. My big question is, why couldn't they put a symbol on the card saying the price is about to change? Would that have ruined the strategic horizons of the game? I'm sincerely curious. I don't know. Like, there are a lot of people who love Kutnaora, and I would like to hear from them. Do they think that that would undermine the nature of the game? Should I have seen these changes coming? Like, is it transparently obvious? I've looked at the cards. I've scrutinized the rules. And I know a lot more about how the levers of the economy changed than after I played my first play. But I still don't know when the magic of thresholds are going to change. Now, sometimes it doesn't really matter all that much whether food costs 5 or food costs 6. But sometimes it really matters whether wood costs 2 or wood costs 3.
It's a dynamic economy.
That's yes.
From the rule book, yes.
Yes, but dynamism outside transparency feels arbitrary.
Yes, it's true.
And so, I mean, again, just to emphasize, much of the time these are margin calls that I don't really care about. Like, I mean, in the most extreme cases, that building you're going to build is either going to cost you $24 or $36. That's really the biggest, I think, swing that you're going to see. For the really expensive buildings that cost 12 wood, that's the swing we're talking about. In those cases, it kind of matters. But in the case where your income action is either going to get you $36 or $33, and then I'm left with this weird sensation. I don't really know what this is going to do, but I know it doesn't really matter. And then I'm like, so why am I doing this? Seriously, that is ultimately the option. Kutnaora is fine. I don't mind playing it. It's okay. But the levers that I'm pulling are still fundamentally opaque to me. And if the key selling point is this dynamic economy, an economy that I'm only able to interact with in this walled subsection of the garden, and I don't even know what's going to happen in this garden, what am I doing here?
Agreed. I still like it.
Sure. There's a lot to like.
So how you play the game is that you have these 6 action cards, and you're going to use these 6 action cards to do 5 actions a turn in a group of 2 and a group of 2 and then a group of 1. And this ranges from building buildings that we've talked about, getting the rights to build those buildings, putting a plot out, building a mine, taking your income, and all of the cards have 2 different actions. So it's this very interesting sort of which cards do I want to use in order to do these actions. And you're going to miss out on some actions because you're going to have to pay certain cards.
Yeah, the whole way that buildings work also strikes me as strange, given that, as I said, the economy is in a state of flux. You're not really in a position to take advantage of the vicissitudes of the economy. Like, you know, here I've got, in the last game of Kutnaora I played the same action cards in the same order 3 consecutive rounds in a row. Because the way buildings work, for example, is, again, so structured that if wood is suddenly cheap, you're seldom, sometimes you are, you're absolutely sometimes in a position to do this, but you're seldom able to really change on a dime and say, no, I'm not going to do that thing. I'm going to strike while the market's hot, and I'm going to build that building while it's cheap, and I'm going to go for that. Mining, you can do that, because mining, if you want to build a mine, it uses wood the same way, but you just play the mine action, you do mining. That part's fine. Building buildings, though, first you take the building, that's an action. Then you designate where the building is going to go, that's another action. And then finally you build the thing, that's the third action. There was an instance near the end of the game where you had 2 turns left, and you were looking to say, okay, I want to build this building. Wait, no, takes 3 actions. Oh, well.
Yeah, well, that's my own fault, right? Because you can be pre-prepared to do all of these things.
No, I hear you.
You can have 3 buildings in sort of limbo, and you can have 3 plots in limbo, even though that will cost you dearly.
It's true.
But yeah,
the game of Kutnaora seems to want to put impediments to you reacting with flexibility towards the dynamic market, and that further makes me feel that it's not playing to its strengths. And that ultimately is what the sense of frustration I feel when playing Kutnaora. There's some interesting stuff here, and there's some good bits. I don't think it hangs together particularly well, and the sort of dynamism of the economy is undercut by a lot of other elements of the game design.
All right, then there's a reputation track, because we've got to have more tracks. There's some things I think that can be pulled right out of this game, which I'll cover in a minute.
Well, but in fairness, I think the reputation track's the only real track.
True.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
That's fine.
Is it, though? Is it really?
And the,
I'm going to lose a reputation.
Yes. Next game. -1. And it intertwines with lots of parts of the game. You get reputation when you build buildings. When you get your reputation at a certain point, it makes putting those plots out super cheap. And if you get it even higher, it makes other things super cheap. And you're going to lose it if you can't pay your taxes. You got to pay taxes.
Got to pay taxes.
Taxes. Every time, taxes.
Taxes.
And so it's a very interesting part of the game. Things that could be cut out. I think that whole St. Barbara's Cathedral and the Pelican tokens, that whole thing can just go away.
I'm inclined to agree. It doesn't deserve pride of place on the action cards, if nothing else. It's a thing that you do very seldom. It is something that you're encouraged to try to do with elements of the game that don't dovetail very well with other elements of the game. And I think that if I were interested in streamlining it, it would go straight out. But of course, it's a Euro game, so you got to build a church.
That's true.
And maybe if I was knee-deep in the rich history of Kutnora, the actual historical context, I would never consent to omitting the part of building a Santa Barbara. But I don't know.
It's got an interesting mid-game transition as well, like between 3 and 4, where you put out more guild buildings. And the guild buildings are a whole thing on their own as well, because you own all the other buildings you put out, but the guild buildings are something else. They all intertwine with all sorts of different rules. But the midpoint, you're putting out more stuff. Then you're starting to do these funky scoring things at the end of every round, where you, when you build the guild buildings, you get nobles. The nobles go into the pool. And then when you take an income action, you can pay money to put the nobles into the scoring thing. And then suddenly that scoring thing is active. And you'd think you went through all that trouble that only you would score the points. But no. Now you've engaged that for everyone. So everyone is now going to score points for that particular part.
It's hard. It's doable in Kutnora, but it's hard to set that up such that you are going to be scoring considerably more than anyone else. Because it's not even so much that the effort is tremendously difficult. The $10 is expensive, but it's not crippling. The bigger problem is that the scoring condition attached to those nobles are the kind of things that everyone's kind of going to be gravitating towards anyway.
Yeah, because they know it might come up.
They know it might come up, and once it comes up, they definitely know they're going to go for it. And besides, as I said, you're kind of in a bit of a walled garden. Your progress is kind of funneled in a certain direction as it is, and those scoring conditions are the kind of things that even if you're playing suboptimally, you can stumble into one or two without too much difficulty.
And the rights, I just want to cover the rights action just quickly, because that's kind of crazy as well, because there's four different columns and they slide along, which I find is interesting. When you build a building, that whole stack of buildings moves to the end and they all slide up. But the fact that that first column is only $1 and the rest can be anywhere from, $12 to $18 to take is such a huge difference.
I would like to issue a minor cultural apology to those in the rest of the world. We use the term dollar for anything relating to currency. This is because we are imperialists.
It's true. So I find it odd and very expensive and not fair. Especially when there is a guild building that you're not even allowed to build, blocking the buildings you want to build. Why would I pay $12 to get that building when I can just wait to pay $1, and why isn't Huey freaking building that building?
It is strange that there are these occasions where you really want to interact with this other bit of the economy, and you're just not allowed to flat, and you're entirely at the mercy of what other people would do. And this is not the kind of good interactive blocking where you look at it and say, oh, but if I leave that there, that gets in it. No, it's just because you don't want to build more meat. You've got all the meat you want. You don't need more meat. This is classic, like, unintentional euro blocking. It doesn't happen all that often, but when it does, it highlights the extent to which in Kutnora you're not really able to pull the levers in a truly interactive way. You talked about the interplay between the buildings that are not owned, that you have to pay a lot to build, and the buildings that are owned, that you pay typically less, but still a fair bit to build. And it's kind of like the overall economy and the overall fluctuating price values of things in Kutnora. It wants to be this sort of highly interactive, highly interdependent game where your actions have a tremendous impact on everyone else around you, and that guides your decision-making processes. I don't feel that it manifests quite that well. When I'm playing a game of Brass or Age of Industry, when I'm playing a trading game, of course, like whether it's a political game like Quo Vadis or Zu Vadis now, or whether it's a negotiation game like Citadel Confluence, when I'm playing a game with a better supply and demand mechanism, some even games that I don't like Power Grid, or games that I do like Navigador, I know what I'm doing. I know the impacts of my actions. I know how it's going to impact my bottom line, and I know how it's going to impact everybody else. And I can act accordingly. Kutna Aura wants to be that experience. I don't think it gets there.
I do agree with all those points, but I do really enjoy the game. I love the market. I love the sort of timing aspect. You know, I complained about not being able to build buildings, but that sort of waiting and trying and figuring out what you can do while you're hoping other players are going to move that market so your buildings will advance, so they'll be cheaper. Blocking people with plots because you can see they're trying to set up the guild sort of combos, and it's like, well, I think I'm going to build there instead. And so that all that, I enjoy that part. I enjoy setting up for the final scoring mechanism. And I feel the flow is pretty good.
The flow is very good. There's not a cumbersome round structure. You're just mostly just doing actions. The elements of upkeep between rounds are negligible. And so things go along at a very, very good clip. And I agree. I enjoy all those elements of interactivity and reactivity as well. But as I say, I think the Kutna Aura could have done a lot better job of arming you better to be reactive in that way, rather than instituting all these either informational or structural barriers to you being able to capitalize on market fluctuations.
Yeah, I do feel that has a limited... I feel as though I would get to a point very shortly where it's like, I have got an optimum score in this particular thing. You know, I really feel as though it's going to play out very similar in game after game. Because, you know, you're doing the same sort of thing, right? It's like,
yes,
I'm these guilds now, so instead of taking the black buildings, now I'm going to build the pink buildings.
Yes. In point of fact, I think the biggest source of variation is just the black buildings as opposed to all the rest of the other buildings. Because the black buildings don't put out production in the same way that other ones do. Without getting too much into the weeds, everyone is producing, well, silver ore, effectively. And so when you build a black building, you're not producing more silver ore. You're, in point of fact, upgrading the mining technologies of everyone. And so that effect is an interesting one. As opposed to everything, whether it's beer or meat, well, food, generally, or wood or timber, whatever. Six of one, half a dozen the other. But the mining technology buildings, I think, are slightly more interesting in that sense.
So long story short, I'm going to keep it for a few more plays. Very much enjoy Kutna Aura.
Kutna Aura is fine. I think this is, it's not quite it. I'll happily play it if someone puts it in front of my face. If someone really wants to play it, I'll play it. I wouldn't suggest it. I would probably try to guide the table away from it. It's got some great ideas. I think this is the kind of thing where a second edition right really be able to get it to work. I think there's some minor informational presentation problems, but mostly I think there are these structural things where it can't really reach the kind of interaction, the kind of dynamism that it wants.
And I think it'll have a really huge learning curve. Like that first game, it's doing things that are so different, especially with the fluctuating market and how the buildings work and how the end game scoring sort of develops.
Yep. To get a heuristic about how the market's going to react, even a heuristic, just a base level heuristic, takes some time. You can explain it properly and that sets a framework, but it doesn't really get you all the way there. And to kind of internalize particularly how buildings work. It's kind of like an ecosystem, an evolutionary process by which you finally get a building to the board, much less the effects of how that's going to work. So yes, there's a bit of a learning curve. And that is Kutna Aura, the City of Silver. And that's going to do it for this week, or will it? Thank you for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. We're certainly not going to have anything after the credits.
Yeah, don't stay around.
Don't stay around. It's time to leave. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. If you want to get in touch with us, you can find all our contact information at sowronggames.com. We read everything you send us and we'll get back to you if we can. Thank you so, so much for spending some time with us. We hope to see you again soon. Take care of your teeth and take care of your trachea.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Biggin. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. You can reach us by email at soveryrongaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter at sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to the glorious return of the segment that everyone asked for secretly deep in their hearts. They didn't want to do anything so gauche as actually say anything about it.
We saw it in their eyes, Mark.
We saw it in their eyes. We saw it in their souls. We heard the silent cries, desperate for Swag Presents Masterpiece Theater.
The sigh that tells a story.
There are two franchises that very much are the core and essence of Masterpiece Theater, and therefore we felt compelled to return. One of them is The Fast and the Furious, as presented by our patron, our glorious patron, Air Doctor Dr. Vincent Duke of Diesel, Esquire, OBE, the Right Honorable. The other being the Sundry Avatar properties. And so Netflix decided to give us some Avatar, and so here we are to talk about Avatar. What did you think about Avatar?
Well, that's pretty well the core of it. They decided that they were going to bring us Avatar.
Yep.
Now, why would they decide this? And why do we need a reimplementation of something that was done so well, and then...
Well, they could have decided to embark on a slightly different kind of project, right? You can always reimagine something. And they could have decided, okay, we're going to do this, I don't know, we're going to do this darker, we're going to redevelop this, we're going to do that. Like, some choices they made, I thought were pretty okay. Like, having Sokka not be a ridiculous misogynist was, I think, largely a good call. He can still be a doofus in a lot of ways. He can still be a sort of... a chauvinist, not in the sense of being sexist, but in the sense of having a false sense of his own importance and a dismissive attitude towards benders, for example. That's what we call an obvious choice. The rest of the choices they made editorial, though, I think are confused and confusing. It's tonally all over the place. And as a consequence, this is my overall critique, visually, thematically, pacing-wise, everything's just flat. It feels just tremendously flat and dull and gray and like,
I think it all has to do with what we've already talked about. They've taken a 20-minute structure and they've pulled it into an hour or more type structure, and they've had to take storylines and try to extend them for that whole time.
Yeah,
where they really could have done 2-part episodes,
right,
and you know, part A, part B, and had them different and sort of played them. And the other thing I was going to talk about was even though the original Avatar felt as though it was day by day. This is Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
Okay.
They never said that it was that.
Right.
They could have done the other days that they didn't show. They could have been all these other stories.
Oh, like an anthology companion thing.
Yeah. Like, why not tell something different? Or, you know, something, you know, there's gaps between Avatar and Korra. Why not do a story there?
Oh, you're right. That might have been interesting. Yeah, I it's so strange because... The running time, we sat down and we did some calculations. The running time is roughly the same.
Yeah.
And it's so bizarre because everything either feels too long or too short. Nothing feels the right length. And I think it's because it's 8 episodes rather than 22. And they were willing to do multi-part episodes in the first season of Avatar. And yet nothing is given either the necessary room to breathe or the punchiness that it deserves. It's really strange.
Well, I think it's in this vein of Disney, right? Of bringing all their animated classics to real life.
Oh, that's a good point.
Thing, right?
This and is part of a broader trend.
I've yet to even watch one of them. I have like just no inkling.
Well, you're not really a huge Disney guy, are you?
Huge.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm very sorry. I had no idea.
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah.
Oh, wow. I didn't know.
But I have not watched a single of the live action ones.
Hmm. Yeah, there are two things that are often the bane of productions like this, in my estimation. CGI animals and child actors. I will say that in the context of child actors, most of them are quite good.
Yes.
Aang, he's very... The word I've seen them used in a lot of reviews is charismatic. The actor they chose for it, he is indeed extremely charismatic.
That is true.
He doesn't always feel perfectly comfortable delivering his lines. There's a certain gravitas that Aang occasionally needs, even though he's like a, 10-year-old boy. The other child actor that I thought was unintentionally or accidentally great was Zuko. He was just chewing the scenery so hard every time. I heard this described in another review as a big theater kid energy. But it was great. It was the only thing that wasn't flat. You know, Everything else just feels so flat. And he shows up and he's like, I am the prince of the Fire Nation. It's like, great. I'm here for it.
Yeah.
CGI animals, garbage.
It's true, yeah.
Real bad.
Yeah, considering how far they've gone lately.
I don't know. I don't think I've ever seen a good CGI animal, frankly. It was the worst part about RRR as well. You remember the CGI animals in RRR?
That's true.
I'm not endorsing animal cruelty, but I'm just saying, if it turns out that some production was abusive to its animals, I'd at least understand where they were coming from.
And when they brought out the general, the grandfather, and I saw the actor that was playing it, I then realized at that moment that I couldn't see anyone else in that role.
Oh, you mean Uncle Iroh?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's still pretty cool, but he's not as cool.
No.
It's not the same.
A different vibe, for sure, but...
Oh, yeah, but in terms of casting, though, yeah. Fire Lord Ozai?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that guy's nasty. He was so good.
He was really good, and he's super dreamy. I just found him very distracting. Anyway. Yeah, honestly... They've renewed it for two more seasons.
And that's it, right? It was three. Right?
Yeah, it was three seasons. So they're going to do all of it. They're going to do the entire story. Something.
And I enjoyed watching it.
I kind of enjoyed bits of the first couple episodes, but then not so much. I'm not going to be watching any more of this.
What's the daughter's name? The daughter's name.
The daughter's name.
Yeah, the Fire Lord's daughter.
Azula.
Azula. I thought they did that whole line very well, and even better than they did in the cartoon. Like, her ambition and reason.
Oh yeah, they've set her up much better. That's true. Her as a character was introduced much sooner, and with more substance. I'll be frank. I have no intention of watching seasons 2 and 3. I don't know if they're gonna.
But the Earthbender.
No.
No.
Oh no, Toph is fine. But yeah. But she gets to. I've seen Toph.
Okay. I know, but I'm interested to see how they portray her.
Sure. I'm just hoping... This is a ridiculous hope. All right? Here's what I want. I have grievances, historical grievances. I want them to do Korra Season 3 with Henry Rollins playing the same role that he voiced, and I want them to do it right. I want them to do... I have a headcanon version of Season 3 of Korra, where it's actually set up properly and it's actually about politics. Because Season 3 tried to be about politics and they messed it up. They completely failed. And I'm so angry about Season 3 of Korra. You have no idea how angry I am. If they get to Season 3, if they cast Henry Rollins, then maybe I'll watch that. So thank you for joining us for Swag Presents Masterpiece Theater. Please do take care and enjoy your culture.
Bye-bye.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.